Jim, I'm glad you came in. I called the publisher earlier in the week because I wasn't sure. A lot of the talk shows have been canceled. And indeed, my feature, which is heard locally and on about six other CBS stations. I don't know about the other stations, but it's been canceled here. All of our features have been canceled in order to cover war news.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, we have a feature related to the war,
yeah.
Which is not too easy for BookBeat.
Yeah, right.
Yet, I mean, in a couple of years, I'm sure there'll be some novels coming out of it.
In a couple of months, they'll be. Yeah. I know there are guys cranking them out right now.
Yeah. Although it took a long time for the Vietnam War to be written about.
That's true.
I don't know. Maybe that was such a traumatic experience, or I don't know. But just now, really, 15 years or more. When was the war? 15 years, 20 years after the war. We're just really reading some good stuff by Philip Caputo and Tim O'Brien.
Yeah.
And William Wright. I think it's William Wright. And a few of these other guys, many of whom served in combat there.
Yeah.
But many were young, too, when you think about it. You know, when you're young, it's kind of hard to... When I was 20, I wanted to be a novelist. And I would sit down at my typewriter and try to write something. I didn't have anything to write about.
Yeah.
And even if I'd been in a war, you know, I don't think I could have put it together very well.
Yeah, that's how I felt at 20, exactly. And but I was in a publishing house the last time I was in New York, before the war got going. But, you know, when the buildup was there, and they already had a paperback on Saddam Hussein, it was there, it was ready for the media. So I feel that there's going to be a blitz of this kind of stuff. Maybe not on a high level like Tim O'Brien and the others, but I think there'll be opportunists right in there swinging.
Have you been watching the television coverage of this war?
Oh, God, yes.
It's surreal, isn't it?
Isn't it? And, you know, it's amazing the... quality of art and music that was ready on the networks the moment it all started. It had all been prepared beforehand. That powerful, stirring style of music that is accompanying this horrendous thing.
Yeah, are you talking about jingles?
When CBS, when Dan Rather comes on, when Peter Jennings comes on, just as they come on, there's this thundering kettle drums, you know, to precede them. It is the sound of war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the artistic introduction to the nightmarish reportage. That's amazing.
That's what WCBS Radio did here. They have suspended all of the regular news jingles, and they have a special war jingle.
Yeah.
I don't know where they got it,
the
but they just produced
mean?
It.
Yeah,
just like
right. That. I'm sure all of this stuff was prepared like Churchill's obituary. It's prepared in advance. Well, we had our own prepared in advance, you know, with the soundtrack to accompany it. This is the most peculiar thing about it that I see. It is being able to witness the media... and this is a cliche already. I'm not saying something that others haven't already said, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, it's a strange thing. What happens, I know at WCBS Radio here in New York, they have purchased a package of ready-made jingles. They're electronic, and they're for almost any occasion. Some of them are specially tailored so that the call letters are in there, but you hear them a lot. I don't think they use musical instruments. You know, it's all through synthesizers and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it, but they can create almost any mood, any atmospheric jingle, music break that you need. It is kind of strange, though, because when you hear it, it sets a mood. It sets this feeling of impending doom or conflict.
Yes, that's right.
Kind of like movie music.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But it isn't a movie. You know, when you watch a movie, a created movie with actors who die only for 5 minutes and then get up again, it's still very powerful. Well, this isn't a movie. It's 100,000 times more significant and powerful than a movie. And yet, it looks like a movie. For those of us who are sitting here, it looks like a movie.
It does.
But, you know, it's not. And the danger, I suppose, is thinking in some way that we're not involved, that we're still spectators, that we're not involved. But my dreams, my meditations have shown me that we are clearly, every one of us, so possibly deeply involved in this, in what you'd call our collective psyche. You know, we're participating to a degree that is unique in all of mankind's history. Never has an entire globe pointed, one focused like this, on any single event. What the hell does this mean for the human spirit?
I don't know. Strangely, it makes me want to go back to real journalism again.
Yes.
I'd like to have Wolf Blitzer's job. I'd actually like to be over there. I really would. I thought that I've been in the business for 30 years. I thought I'd really like to kind of take it easy and just have a desk job and interview authors and this sort of thing. But, you know, all of a sudden this thing broke out and my adrenaline began pumping again. And I guess the old journalistic roots haven't left.
Yes, sure. And I felt the same way. I wished that I were a journalist again.
Behind your own $50,000 satellite telephone. Where did you practice your journalism?
In New York City.
In what capacity?
In the capacity of a reporter, editor for a newspaper, much like the fictional Midnight Examiner. Yes, the stories that I wrote were not those of world-shattering importance. South American woman gives birth to puppies. Those were the kind of stories that I handled. That was my beat. So... But once a journalist, always a journalist.
Yeah. Have you written screenplays as well?
Yeah.
You didn't write the screenplay for E.T., did you?
No, I didn't.
I wrote the novelization,
yeah. But I wrote the screenplay for Book of Love, which is premiering tonight, so that certainly is something I do and will do more of.
What is that like as compared to writing in the novelistic form?
Well, what's most interesting is that in a novel, if you're going to have a forest, you have to put all the leaves on the trees and all the shadows and all the little nuances of color. And in a screenplay, all you say is forest, and let the other guys worry about it. This is the best part of writing a screenplay. You just have to concentrate on dialogue and plot, and all the texture is somebody else's department. This frees up the mind in a certain way, which is why a screenplay goes much more quickly than a novel. 6 weeks for a screenplay, you know, 6 years for a novel sometimes.
But the Book of Love, I mean, the Book of Love, that's yours.
Yes.
The screenplay, it seems to me, has so many fingers, potentially has so many fingers in it. Is it really yours?
Well, it's mine up to a point, as my father used to say. And that point is where, you see, every writer, every screenwriter thinks he's a director. And every director thinks he's a screenwriter. And you have conflict there because I want to do it my way. Who the hell wouldn't? Unless I have to watch somebody doing it his way. And I'm glad when he gets it just the way I would have gotten it. And in Book of Love, I think quite a bit of it is gotten the way I would have gotten it. But of course I have my own vision of it.
Who's the director?
Bob Shea, who owns New Line Cinema, creators of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and the Nightmare on Elm Street.
How did he handle some of the sex scenes, such as those at the Boy Scout camp?
Oh, I think he handled them very amusingly. I mean, we're not into showing anything but the comic side of adolescent depravity.
It wasn't, when I was an adolescent, though, it wasn't comic.
No.
It may have been depravity, but it wasn't comic.
Yes, I mean, when I walked into that Boy Scout camp in real life as a kid and saw that one of my compatriots had been chained naked to his bunk with a candle stuck in his ass, a lighted candle, I felt, you know, this is possibly not the place for me. This is not the Boy Scouts motto as I understand it. And so that's in the movie, and I think it's handled with taste, if such a thing as a lighted candle can be tasteful. Given.
I hope it's done in the shadows somehow.
Yes, it is done in the shadows. Well, it has a PG-13 rating, and perhaps that's what the parents have to advise their kids on, what it means to see that little birthday candle sequence. It was his birthday, you see, that's why they gave him a candle. And there was nothing else. That was the most sadistic thing. Boy Scout camp was the most sadistic thing I have ever seen. You know, that's just how it was. You get a bunch of young guys together saluting, and they're bound to make trouble for each other.
Adolescence is sadistic. I equated with the characters in the Book of Love because they're about my age. And I also went to a Boy Scout camp in Ohio about that same time, I guess, in the early 50s.
Yes.
And that was where I first saw a how do I phrase this for the microphone? I first saw a strange male organ erect. The first time I ever saw him. Now, nothing happened to me or us as brutally as in the Book of Love.
Yes.
At Boy Scout camp, but it was where you saw some of the facts of life for the first time.
Right. And where you try and swim around a distant dock without drowning, you know, and they toss you in and expect you to do these things. I went to my bunk, laid down, and opened up a comic book. That was my idea of how to spend an afternoon, and the scoutmaster, whoever he was, came in and saw me there and put me to work raking leaves. You know, this was my little Boy Scout vacation. But to all those Boy Scouts out there who are listening, my motto to you is be prepared.
you know, you know how many parents are going to drag their kids out of the Scouts now.
Yeah, right.
But I hated the Scouts. I mean, I hated the militaristic attitude that they took, where we had to line up. I was in the covered wagon patrol. We had our own patches. My patch had a covered wagon on it. But you had to salute, and you had to... there were some very embarrassing things. In the auditorium at the local elementary school where we had our meetings, the scoutmaster would call on one of us to go out and lead the pledge to the flag.
Yes.
And one day he called on me, and there must have been 100 kids there lined up in their patrols, you know. And I had to saunter out to the middle of the floor to lead the pledge, and I forgot it. I couldn't think of the first word or the last word. I was so embarrassed.
Yes.
Wow. I only joined it because they had a radio show on WSPD in Toledo called the Boy Scout Buckskin Scoutaroo, and my best pal, who was in the Scouts, was on that show, and I wanted to be on that show too. So
yeah.
He said, well, look, if you want to get on the radio, you could join the Boy Scouts, and I know the director of the show because I'm on it every week, and I'll get you on the show. That's how I made my radio debut.
Yes. Well, you see, Boy Scouts had something for each of us. Of the 250 merit badges or whatever it is that you need to get to become an Eagle Scout, I got only one, the bookbinding merit badge. That's kind of strange, you know, learn how to glue the cover back on a book that's falling apart, a curious shadow of my future to come, you know, that books would be my life. And I, of course, I loved it as well as hated it. With all things you love, you've got to hate them too, and that's what it was for Boy Scouts. As for the rest of the sex in Book of Love, I mean, it was... I wanted to write a handbook that a 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid could read and realize, oh, this is what I'm going through. This is what it's really like. This is the real side of growing up. You open up your father's drawer and you find compliments of Duke's Barbershop, a little undressing lady thing that you could play. You pull out a piece of cardboard and her clothes disappear. You know, I thought, my dad has this in his drawer? You know, I thought, you know, kids should know about this. And I wondered whether a kid actually would finally read this book and be delighted with it.
I tell you, what I really like, one of my favorite parts of this book is when he is very... This actually spans quite a number of years, I mean, going into adolescence.
Yeah.
I guess he starts when he's around seven.
Yeah.
Around seven. And I love the opening scenes where he is the Lone Ranger and he's galloping through the neighborhood, because I remember myself galloping. You know, all kids gallop like we're on a horse.
Yes, we all have got the invisible pony, and... As long as we can ride it, we're free. And as in that book, when the lady says, what do you think you're doing? Why don't you grow up? And his pony vanishes from between his legs. And he's lost. He's no longer the Lone Ranger. He's no longer riding free on the winds of his imagination. It's a very sad moment. Yeah.
One thing that kind of puzzled me a little bit was the language, which was very... blunt and very realistic as it might be spoken today, but as when I grew up, I don't think we talked like that. I don't think we were allowed to.
Well, we certainly weren't allowed to, but in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is a tough mining town, and these guys, my father, his grandfather, these people, all the male members in the family worked in the mines. I've been down there 1,000 feet under the ground. If you don't come out of that swearing and filled with a certain... filled with aggression and everything else that goes with it, you're not normal. That's what it was like to grow up in Scranton. It was a tough place, and there was people said it like it was.
So the language was vivid as you grew up.
Very vivid. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just, everybody was salty, you know, they just were.
Mm-hmm. Does the Book of Love take place in Scranton?
Is this
So does it parallel many of the events in your own childhood?
Oh, that is my so-called life. Yeah, everything in there, guaranteed, is true. That's the closest autobiographical thing that I've done. I wanted to try and somehow convey what it's like to grow up in a small American town without a single advantage. Except the valley spirit itself, I suppose, that there's something there. There's the spirit of the place you live, and while it's salty, it's also sweet.
Yeah. Now, the Book of Love is just out as a trade paperback, but it was published before. Tell me a little bit about its publishing history.
Well, it was first published as Jack in the Box, and the hero is Jack, and the box that he's in is adolescence, really. And Jack out of the box, Jack in the box, Jack out of the box, is his growing up and leaving the repressed style of the 50s that I grew up in. You know, that was the Eisenhower era. It was hard to be a kid then. Well, it's always hard to be a kid, but the particular difficulty of that time is also what I address in the book. I don't know, how shall I say it? The Iron Maiden.
Well, there was a certain degree of repression in that, and there were certain things you couldn't do and you couldn't say, and we've mentioned language before. I mean, if I had used any of the words that are found in your book, The Book of Love, I mean, my mother would give me the back of her hand. I mean, it just wasn't done, and nor was it done in my circle or in my high school, and it was very, very strict. I mean, in junior high school, we had to march from class to class. We couldn't speak.
Yes.
We were allowed to talk.
Yes.
And we had to say prayers before classes. And it was, I mean, there was a great deal of governmentally imposed religion that would not be accepted today.
And I found it damaging. I didn't think that that was any good for any of us. It certainly didn't do me any good. And I remember being paddled by a paddle that I myself had made in the wood shop. And this was a substantial paddle. It was about 3 feet long, and the man wielding it was Short Circuit Jones, who taught the electric shop class. I don't know what I'd done. I crossed the wrong wire or something, and Short Circuit let me have it with that paddle. And when he wound up and came through with it, holy cow, I mean, you literally left the ground. Now, that was daily practice for keeping us in line.
Now it would be a jail term.
Yeah,
for this
sure
guy.
Would. So how have we changed, and are we doing something better now? I think
I don't know.
So. Well,
I don't know.
Perhaps not.
I don't know. Book of Love is such a nostalgic book that if you say we're doing things better now, we look back at these days with a certain degree of nostalgia. And the 40s, too. I mean, I overlap. And I look back at them with a certain degree of nostalgia. But, you know, there's one thing that they didn't have in the 40s that is really vital today. And I don't know how we live without it. It's penicillin.
Yes.
When you think about it, they developed it during World War II, or late 30s, actually, but it was not put into use. I wonder how many people died of all sorts of diseases that could have been easily cured by penicillin.
Yes.
And you look back at these wonderful nostalgic days, and it was a lot easier to die.
Yes, it sure was.
Well, let's talk a little more about your background and how you became a writer and how it all developed for you. You grew up in Scranton, and then what happened?
Yes, well, at the age of 8, I wrote my first poem. When I wake in the morning, this is what I see: black tower, blue sky, green tree. I thought, not bad.
That's not bad.
There may be a future in this. But I did not pick it up again until I was in college and discovered that co-eds were attracted by poets. And then I realized the even better reason for entering this profession. That, I suppose, is my true beginning. Then I came to New York and...
Where did you go to school?
Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
And
you studied English?
Studied English, if you can call never going to class studying. But I was involved in the theater. I felt that that was really where I was hearing what I wanted to hear,
you acted.
I acted.
You do have a very nice presentation, vocal presentation.
Ah, well, so do you. I acted and came to New York with the idea of being an actor, and directed an early underground film when I got here, which I wrote.
I hope you knew how to drive a cab as well.
You know, I was a chauffeur. I knew how to drive a very long black limousine. I drove the chauffeur. I was the chauffeur for the man who owned the Merritt Farms outfit. Do you remember Merritt Farms?
Oh,
in
yeah.
New York City?
They made great conditions.
Yeah, that's right. And I was being groomed for a career in Merritt Farms.
As a chauffeur.
As, you know,
as the head chauffeur.
I might have had more of a career, but I could never count the cans in the store. I was supposed to learn the entire business, and there was a way of going through the stores and taking the inventory, and you could tell how many cans were in a row just by looking at, I don't know, something and multiplying it. And I could never figure out how many cans were in the row, so my future at Merritt Farms was brief. However, when I was a chauffeur, I used to go down to Wall Street, and the owner would go in to the stock market, and I would sit there reading Dostoevsky. And it was a great way to live. I recommend it to every young artist. If he can get a job as a chauffeur and spend long times parked somewhere, you can get a lot of good reading done.
But you said you did direct.
Yeah, I directed. Well, every writer thinks he's a director, and I thought I was. And this was this was the time that John Cassavetes was doing Shadows, and there were other underground films getting started. That movement was very important in New York, and I got into it. The movie never got anywhere, and nobody ever saw it but me. However, I felt that this is what I really was, this is what I wanted to be. Then I worked as a journalist for the sleaze newspapers and got some hands-on experience with all of that.
What was the name of the newspaper?
This, I think, would be better left unsaid.
I just loved Midnight Examiner when I read it. You know, if you had altered the punctuation a little bit and the sentence structure, it would read like a Robert Coover. It really would. You know.
Yeah.
He wrote one book that reminds me of this. I can't remember the title. Gerald's Party, it was called, and it was one paragraph. The whole book was one paragraph. He never stopped.
Yeah.
Never broke.
Yeah.
And this was almost like it. This was nonstop hilarity.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
It was one of these books where you actually broke out laughing, or I would break out laughing. Just being in journalism myself and admiring some of these tabloids at the supermarket,
yeah,
you know, it
yeah.
really hit home.
They are admirable. If you worked at a place like this, you had to think writing is the most powerful tool there is. Look at these insane stories we're writing, and people are reading them. They believe them. They believe the South American woman gave birth to puppies. That's when I knew.
Was that your best story?
That was my best story, yes.
What were some of the other good stories
you wrote? Man wheat eats wife's gerbils. They were tasty. He said, I'd do it again. You know, that kind of stuff. Anything that you could possibly manufacture is a story. The more outrageous, the better. So this gave my imagination its first real stretch. And I've never recovered.
Well, did this lead to real writing?
Oh, well, after recognizing the power of the written word, I thought, no, I've just got to continue with this. And I started writing stories that they hadn't really found, you know, I hadn't found what writing I could do until I suddenly had a memory one day of a time in grade school when Marie, this little girl in class with me, at the end of the year, decided to celebrate somehow by lifting up her dress and showing her panties to the boys in the classroom. And when I started writing this, I thought, wow, this is it. This is what it's all about. It's about this simple, innocent, beautiful little creature and what she did that day and how misunderstood she was when the teacher came in and saw her doing this and traumatized her and me and the rest of us in the midst of this nuptial celebration. And that was the first story of mine that was published, because it was the first story of mine that was real and true and from the true heart, you might say. Once I discovered that, Marie was my muse. She was my true muse. I didn't know that back then in grade school, but I sure realized it that day when that memory opened up and there it was. That was the true beginning. It was just like a door that opened, and I went through that door, and after that I knew how to write. It's amazing.
Marie is my muse now, too. I'd like to meet that girl someday.
Yeah.
Tell me about you've written a lot of books here. The Exile, is that your first novel?
No, my first novel was Hermes 3000. Uh-huh. Named after my typewriter. It was a Hermes 3000.
Well, all of these are not quite in sequence here in this list.
No, I guess not.
Well, tell me about Hermes and how that came about.
Well,
what year was that?
Early 70s. I was living in a one-room camp in the Canadian North Woods.
How did you get up there?
I wanted to live in the wilderness. I spent a lot of time in New York, and I finally wanted to get away and live in the country, and I just kept traveling north until I could find a place cheap enough to buy and live, and it was not until I got across the border.
You were living on your Merritt Farms earnings?
By then, I was living on the slim advance that I'd made from Elephant Bang's Train, which was my first short story collection. I had enough to escape. I bought a 200-acre farm in New Brunswick, Canada for $8,000. You know, that was, and I knew I could make it. And so, but it burned down. It burned down on Halloween. I don't know how. And there we were, Elizabeth Gundy, the novelist, my wife, and I, without any place to live. And an old lumberjack said, "You can stay in my camp. I've got this cook's camp. You can shack up in there for the year." And that's what we did. We were there through the most incredibly bitter winter imaginable. And I wrote Hermes 3000, which was about, it was a sort of like a flower. Each petal was a different time. Contemporary Manhattan, an elderly man wandering in the Metropolitan Museum. At the same time, interlaced with that, a guard for Catherine of Russia on duty, and his life and the life of the old man in the museum interlocking in the imagination. Other lives interlocking that way. It was a long and silent winter.
But a very productive one.
Yeah, I realized I could write a novel, you know, under adverse circumstances.
And that novel was published. Then you had no problem after that.
No. As always, when you begin, you have beginner's luck. And people are very cordial and welcoming. It's only after you've published a few books that things get much more difficult.
In what way?
Well, I don't know exactly. Critically, then you have to run a much more aggressive... They're all lined up then. The critics line up after. They give you the grace, beginner's grace. You're given grace, and then after that it gets much more difficult. It's been like that ever since. It's peculiar. I think that any writer you'll talk to will, except for a few, will tell you that it was like that.
Well, maybe it's they look upon, if you line up the books, they say, well, you can do it. Now you're fair game. We can criticize it easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I tell you, they don't necessarily spare a first novelist. I wrote a novel that was published by St. Martin's Press in 1988. It's a thriller centered around H.L. Mencken. The Baltimore Sun gave it four columns, a banner headline, and they extended the review into the interior of the paper. And it was savage.
Okay.
Oh, it was savage. The guy didn't even know me. And I think the best thing he said was, "Swaim's writing is serviceable."
Well,
that was the best thing he said. Well, but I just wondered, there was such anger in that novel, and I would in that review, and I would admit that the novel wasn't very good. It was at first effort, and not, but I tried. But I wasn't bearing any grudge against anybody. I was trying to give people a good time with this book. And I just wondered about the motivation of someone who savages somebody who, well, what purpose? I mean, maybe the book isn't any good and maybe you have to say it, but I mean, in the kind of, he savaged it the way H.L. Mencken would have savaged it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a terrible blow that he gave you, and I hope that you can ignore it because it's not, you know, criticism used to be much different. Oscar Wilde was a critic, and his idea of criticism was that it was a true art form. The man who was the critic had to be as skilled in what he was criticizing as the person he was criticizing. He had to be a man of letters, a man of wit, a man of erudition, and his criticism should be extremely creative. Well, there's nothing really like that. There are a few exceptions, but by and large, that is not the state of criticism. It's just an avenue of vituperation, such as you experienced. It hurts. When you tell me that story, it really hurts me because I see that it's hurt you, and I think that's terrible.
Well, not really. I mean, I got a lot of good reviews, too, but strangely, I put the Savage review up on the bulletin board.
That's right.
And people came up to me, they read the review, they came up to me and said, "Hey, congratulations on that review in the Baltimore Sun." So, but you know, It's especially bad in movie criticism. You know the definition for a television movie critic, don't you?
No.
It's the station manager's brother-in-law.
Yes, right.
So there's no real standards in movie criticism, really.
No.
There are more in book criticism because especially good reviews like the New York Times will farm out reviews to one hopes responsible reviewers. Doesn't always happen.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I would consider myself a responsible reviewer or critic, because the time, as Oscar Wilde has defined it, the time that really truly good criticism takes is more than I have to spare. So I don't know who those good critics are. I'm probably getting myself into hot water, but you know, it's not the kind of reviews I read. I don't consider them criticism. They're something else. There's like reports, but they aren't criticism. Very different.
Yeah. You tell me about E.T. and the novelization. You made a lot of capital on that, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that was, I call my house the house that E.T. built. You know, there was, I think it was, yes, it was Dr. Johnson. He said, anyone who tells you they wrote for any other reason but for money is an idiot. I like to think that...
Only a blockhead would write, yeah, I think.
Yes, that's it. You know the quote, yeah. Only a blockhead. So, of course, it did make a lot of money, and I desperately needed it. But what was amazing is that I really loved doing it, because E.T. was a true force in the world. He was dawning for our consciousness, the little helper from the stars. I didn't really know this when I got into it. I went out, I met Spielberg. He showed me he had guarded down a locked hallway inside a locked room, inside a locked closet, a sealed cardboard box in which the first model of E.T. was housed. And secretly, we opened this up. He was very paranoid about anybody knowing what this was about. And I was shaking hands with the little rubber geek and wondering if... I remember saying to myself, looking at Spielberg, one of us must be crazy. But, well, it shows, you know, who the crazy one was. But I knew when I read the script that this was incredibly charming. Because that's how I get into it. He sent me the script and said, do you want to do the novelization of this? And I read the scene where E.T. is listening to the mother of the kids reading Peter Pan, and he was listening to this. And I thought, Jesus, this little space creature is a lost boy. He's Peter Pan. That's really who he is. This is going to be wonderful. And because of that scene, I decided to write this novelization. And when I got into it, I felt the spiritual force of E.T. You know, it was a spiritual force. The world just was amazed by it. And I felt it when I started writing it. I felt that there was energy there. That's all I can say. An amazing energy, archetypal, if you will. Something was happening in our collective mind called E.T. So it was a wonderful time for me. I loved writing it. I loved being inside E.T.'s mind. He was an amazing little creature.
What an amazing reversal, taking a screenplay and making it into a novel.
Yeah.
Taking it, and here in the Book of Love, you take a novel and make it into a screenplay.
Yeah, there it's the reverse. I didn't have to worry about the dialogue or the plot. They were given to me. What I had to worry about for my novelization was the texture, all the things that Steven Spielberg could just point a camera at and create. All that texture was not in the screenplay. It was left out. Well, it had to be put in the book, because that's what it would be, what I could give people that they couldn't get off the screen. E.T.'s thoughts were very important. I thought his thoughts were beautiful, and that I could give them to people, whereas the movie couldn't. All they could give were the few words that he could speak, but I could give his ideas about us, and that's what was wonderful about it for me. And I think that that's what made it a good book.
You are still living in the country?
Yeah.
Where?
In Maine.
What's it like sharing a home with another writer?
Well, it's wonderful. I just...
You don't have to argue over who gets the typewriter on a given day now, do you?
No, we each have computers, thank God, which makes it easier to abandon projects when Elizabeth Gundy tells me they aren't any good. I just handed her 3 months' work, and she said, sorry. You know, that's what it's like to have a writer living beside you whose word you trust.
How does that make you feel when she says sorry?
Sorry, and instantly I know exactly what she means. Everything that I've hidden from myself in order to do something, in order to delude myself, I have to hide a certain amount of things. And she's able to see them. She was able to see that clearly, and just in 5 minutes. I didn't protest. Sometimes I really protest. Now, Book of Love was twice as long as it now is. And when she read it, she said, cut the last 600 pages. And that one really threw me for a loop. I had to immediately phone Len Levinson, a New York writer, and fly him up to Provincetown at my expense immediately to read the book. He read it and he said, cut the last 600 pages. So I knew that I had to. With a little help from my friends, it seems, I'll finally get to publish it the right way. But when I go up the attic and look at those 600 pages, I still say, they were wrong and I was right. You know, I can't give up.
Can you still use these 600 pages in another form?
Have I asked myself that many times?
I hate to waste a word.
Sure. You know, maybe someday. But I don't think so. You know, I think that they're just right. You know, you've got to know when you've succeeded and when you've failed.
God, there's so many technical problems to writing that the reader doesn't realize.
Yeah, yes. You know, I just read the other day, Hemingway handed The Old Man and the Sea to someone. He said, open it up, run your finger down the page, and see if you can take out one word anywhere. Find an extra word and take it out. And that person couldn't find an extra word and take it out. That, to me, is what the hard part is getting out all those extra words until it becomes streamlined. And this is a consciousness-raising thing, to find out how many words you don't need and to try and write it, as you said, like one long paragraph, that the rhythm just carries you along and sweeps you along. Those are not normal rhythms. Nobody thinks like that. You know, nobody can speak like that. That only comes after that long and laborious working on those rhythms. You know, that's the hard part.
And to a great extent, that's something you learn yourself, isn't that right?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody can just say, this is what you have to do, take out all the extraneous words. I think when you write something, you don't know that you have extraneous words in there until you sit there and study it and think and go back and maybe put it aside. Hemingway, you mentioned Hemingway. He would write a good portion of a novel and put it aside for months, sometimes a year, and then go back to it so he could look at it.
Yeah.
In a fresh way.
Yes, and that kind of distance is a sort of trance, and he needed months to do it. Sometimes it doesn't take that long, and sometimes it can take years. You know, I've got things that I've written years ago that I know time will give me the handle on this one, but the time hasn't come yet. Nabokov used to completely cogitate his novels until they were fully formed in his mind before he ever put a word down on paper, the whole novel. And for him, that's why he could write on index cards, because he would just write down, yes, that scene, I remember that, I thought of that, and then this one, and it would be a different scene on each index card, but it was all there already formed in his mind. And he wouldn't start writing until that complete formulation had been made. That amazes me, that he could have thought the whole thing through in that detail. But of course, that's the sort of mind he had. I'm much different. I like to jump in and start running into the unknown. I don't want to know what's up ahead. And maybe this is a weakness. I'm not sure. I would have liked to have the strength that Nabokov had to...
That's interesting you say that. I was talking to Bobby Ann Mason, who works similarly to yourself. She will maybe have an idea, just an image, and she'll put a piece of paper in the typewriter or word processor and just go from there without a defined idea as to what she's going to write, and somehow it works for her.
Yeah.
Seems to me that's really hard, though.
It is hard, but if you're an intuitive type, which she probably is, you know, your intuitions are what matter, and they aren't something that you can very carefully structure and get them nailed down and have it charts, you know, flow charts and all the rest of that. That's like a prison for a certain type of writer. Certainly for me, it acts like a... It's too confining, and yet I think it's a good thing. And so my struggle is to make myself become someone very carefully structured and organized before I start. It's hell. You know, there's no life in it. I don't feel the life in any of that. I only feel the life when I'm on the mat with my opponent. You know, then it's real.
Speaking of opponents, when you live with another writer, is there a competitive air?
No, not at all. I'm just happy for her progress and she for mine. There is just none of that. Although I know that given other sorts of temperaments, there can be tremendous competitiveness between, and certainly Hemingway, who was competitive to begin with, married women who are also competitive and were also writers. Martha Gellhern, Mary Hemingway, they were in competition with him, and that must be a killer. You know, I don't know how you could possibly survive that, but you know.
He was different, though. He was a man unique. I was reading the this new book by Charles Scribner Jr. Just came out. Matter of fact, there's a review of it in today's Times, and it's about his life as a publisher, and he knew Hemingway. He had a lot of interesting stories about Hemingway, and it's a very interesting book if you can pick up a copy.
Yes, the one that I've just finished is by, I think, Dennis Bryan. It's a collection. The entire book is quotes from friends and colleagues of Hemingway. There's nothing biographical other than what they say about him, and it's extremely illuminating.
Well, William Kotzwinkel, it was really a lot of fun talking to you. I'm anxious to see the movie, and although you wrote the screenplay, but I still think I have a prejudice toward the book. Books are almost always better, but I'll have an open mind about that. A Book of Love is a delightful, charming book, and those readers who didn't catch it the first time around are going to like it this time. William Kotzwinkel, thank you very much.
Thank you.